From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the Afghan war's cost in innocent lives, Tibetan exiles in India, and spy flights over communist China. In Afghanistan, the killing of innocent people in US and NATO military airstrikes has badly damaged relations with the Afghan people. The deaths come at a time when the NATO-led coalition says it's stepping up efforts to stamp out the Taliban insurgency. So the United States, in particular, is reaching out to make amends. American military teams are often sent to meet the affected villagers and to make condolence payments. NPR's Soraya Sahadi Nelson reports from eastern Afghanistan.
One by one, the elders from Nadar Shakot file into the governor's office here in Khost province. They walk past the U.S. military team, whose members rise up from their chairs. It's a noisy procession, but the Americans and Afghans don't speak to each other, at least not yet.
The best thing we can do is let people like the governor lead us through this.
That's Army Major David Baumgartner. He and the other Americans here look a bit uncomfortable. What they do next will determine whether residents of this village will ever let them return to finish building a school. They are here to undo the damage caused by an American unit that swooped into Nadar Shakot on a late-night raid in March. They were members of a special operations team based elsewhere in the country. When the raid ended, six people were dead, including a mother and two children. Two other villagers were arrested. The governor is not happy about the raid. Usually the Americans consult him before going in, but he's determined to help the military right this wrong, lest the insurgents gain from the tragedy. After the villagers are seated, he nods in the team's direction. Navy Commander Erica Sauer, who heads the U.S. Provincial Reconstruction Team that is here to mend relations, speaks first.
This is a very great loss, but we are here to try and help you get through this situation.
Cale Weston, the U.S. State Department representative, is more direct.
I think this is a tragedy for you, and I know that. And our goal today is not to try and explain away what happened, but to try and, as Commander Sauer said, help you through your loss, but also try and make sure it doesn't happen again.
And so begins a tough 40-minute meeting, a meeting that under international law doesn't have to take place, nor do American payments need to be made to relatives of the dead, which in this case amounts to $2,000 for each of the six people killed. But the Americans believe such meetings and payment help keep Afghanistan from ending up back in the hands of the Taliban. So does Sarah Holowinski, the executive director of the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, a non-governmental organization in Washington, D.C.
So if you don't offer some sort of recognition of suffering and some sort of assistance, whether it's monetary or in-kind assistance for civilian harm, you are going to see a tremendous amount of anger.
Back in Khost, the meeting is not going so well. Tribal leader Amir Muhammad demands the soldiers who conducted the raid be brought to justice. So should the informant who told the Americans his village harbored terrorists. He demands that two villagers who were arrested in the raid be released. He says otherwise, the apology the Americans are offering is meaningless. The Americans agree to relay the message. Then they hand over the money. Three stacks of crisp orange Afghani bills are removed from a gray metal box and placed on a conference table in front of the survivors. The youngest, Qadir Gul, with adolescent fuzz on his chin, looks at the money. He then glares at the Americans. He's one of the children who are supposed to attend the school they are building in his village. Though he says little during the meeting, he has lost more than any of the Afghans here. His father, his mother, his 10-year-old brother.
That the Americans build schools and roads does mean something, but this shouldn't have happened.
He and his uncles want to know why they weren't told the coalition believed insurgents were in their midst. They say there weren't any, but if there were, they would have turned them over. But it's not that simple. Colonel Martin Schweitzer, who heads the U.S. forces here, says most of the raids are conducted with Afghan cooperation, but sometimes coalition forces need to act independently. He says in this case, some of the dead, as well as the two arrested men, were insurgents linked to hundreds of Afghan deaths.
And so we go in there to try to constantly refine the procedures and the techniques we're using to reduce the chances that any casualty, let alone civilian casualties, are going to be incurred.
Qadargul says he doesn't care. What he does care about is that the Americans have left him an orphan with 8 younger brothers and sisters to raise. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Khost Province.
The recent events in Tibet were followed closely in India, which hosts about 100,000 Tibetans living in exile. That number includes the Dalai Lama, who's based in the northern Indian town of Dharamsala. The Dalai Lama seems to be under pressure from all sides, from China, which is now accusing him and his followers of planning suicide attacks, and says it's discovered weapons hidden in Tibetan Buddhist monasteries. The Dalai Lama's administration strongly denies those allegations. And the Dalai Lama is also under pressure from Tibetan exile activists, who say he needs to take a harder line in pursuing the Tibetan cause. NPR's South Asia correspondent Philip Reeves reports.
An elderly Tibetan woman says her morning prayers. Suddenly she stops and points at a picture on the wall beside her. The picture shows a Tibetan man, a political prisoner, it says, in a Chinese jail. The woman shakes her head sadly and returns to her prayers. This is a small Tibetan enclave in New Delhi, a warren of dark and narrow alleys. Anger radiates from the walls. There are close-up photographs of bloodied corpses, purportedly shot during the Chinese security forces' recent crackdown in Tibet. There are signs calling for a boycott of Chinese-made products. There are posters announcing protests. Not far away, Kungchuk Yangpel is sipping tea in a cafe. He's an activist with the Tibetan Youth Congress. It's not easy work. He's been detained by Indian police many times for staging protests, although never for long. He's severed relations with his family, who are still in Tibet, so as not to put them at risk of reprisals from the Chinese authorities. And he has a dilemma.
I totally disagree with Dalai Lama.
Yangpel reveres the Dalai Lama as his spiritual leader. Like everyone, he calls him His Holiness. Yet, he says, he and many other Tibetans fundamentally disagree with the Dalai Lama's political approach to the Tibetan issue. The Dalai Lama wants the Olympic Games to go ahead. Yangpel wants the world to boycott them. The Dalai Lama accepts Tibet as an autonomous region within China. Yangpel believes in pursuing nothing less than full independence.
His Holiness is, His Holiness is too soft for the political issues. Very soft, very peaceful. For situation like this, we have to take action to the China government.
A couple of hundred Tibetans sit beneath a canopy in a street in the middle of New Delhi. This is the latest in a series of peaceful protests by Tibetans in the city in the last few weeks. Among the demonstrators is Rinzin Wangmo. She also says she believes there should be an international boycott of the Beijing Olympics. But she explains the Dalai Lama is considered a god by Tibetans, so she won't even discuss the fact that she disagrees with him.
I can't say anything about this. Whatever he has decided, I think he has done the best. So we are on that way.
China's talk comes to India on April 17th.
Tibetan activists in India are now focusing on the arrival in New Delhi in a few weeks of the Olympic torch now touring the world. They've already scored one success. The captain of India's soccer team has just declined an invitation to carry the torch through the city, saying his decision's out of sympathy for the Tibetan cause. Bhumo Sering is president of the Tibetan Women's Association, based in Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama lives in exile.
Since we will be under very severe surveillance by the Indian government and Indian authorities, we are making a request to the Indian citizens to please speak up for Tibet. You know, when the torch comes here, it is a torch of shame.
Kungchuk Yangpel has a more radical idea. He says the plan is to prevent the Olympic torch from being carried through New Delhi. But that's all he'll say. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
Coming up, a secret war in the skies over China.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. In recent years, both the US and Taiwanese governments have declassified information about their military intelligence cooperation during the Cold War. One story to emerge is that of the Black Bats, a group of Taiwanese pilots who flew dangerous intelligence missions against mainland China with the help of the CIA. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Hsinchu in Taiwan, the Black Bats fought a covert battle in a forgotten war.
The story of the Black Bats came out through the Taiwanese media and this documentary by Hong Kong's Phoenix Television. In the early 1950s on Taiwan, Chiang Kai-shek was looking for ways to retake mainland China, which he had lost to the communists in 1949. The U.S., meanwhile, was battling China in the Korean War. That's me, says Colonel Li Chongshan, pointing to a picture of himself in front of a Boeing B-17 bomber. I was an electronic countermeasures officer, he says. Colonel Li guides me through a military museum in Hsinchu, near the Black Bat's old airbase. Preparations are underway to open a new museum devoted solely to the Black Bats. Colonel Li says the bats painted their planes black and flew only at night. We could pick up anything transmitted by electronic waves, he says. From this, we could probe their air defenses and figure out how their military was deployed. The Black Bats pilots dropped pamphlets encouraging communist pilots to defect. They parachuted spies and saboteurs onto the mainland, few of whom ever made it back. Pilot Dai Shuqing recalls how he relied on skill and guts to accomplish his missions.
Most of their anti-aircraft guns were deployed along the coast. I would fly in 100 feet off the ground. By the time their guns opened fire, they were too late and I was in.
As mainland Chinese air defenses improved, they shot down more of the Black Bats. The Bats flew a total of more than 800 missions, but they lost two-thirds of their pilots in the process. Pilot Zhu Zhen remembers one close call.
One enemy plane in front of me would drop flares. Another plane in back saw me. Their jets were faster. All I could do was dodge. I turned hard and saw the plane behind me firing at my silhouette. I only escaped because he used up all his ammunition.
The Black Bats were joined by the Black Cats, who flew U-2 spy planes over China. Both groups were instrumental in gathering information about China's nuclear weapons program in the mid-1960s. When the pilots returned to base, they turned over their intelligence to Western Enterprises, Inc., a front for the CIA. Western Enterprises equipped and trained the Taiwanese pilots and designed their missions. James Lilly was a CIA case officer in Taiwan during the 1950s and ambassador to China in the 1980s. He explains about Western Enterprises.
They were an organization that was set up in Taipei with a headquarters in Pittsburgh to be a deniable instrument of American policy, which was basically covert, and to work with the people in Taiwan to develop paramilitary operations against China for a second front during the most vicious times of the Korean War.
By the 1960s, the Black Bats were flying missions over North Vietnam, and their missions over China decreased. The U.S. was developing spy satellites that rendered the Black Bats obsolete. Another problem was that the U.S. and Taiwan had different strategic objectives. U.S. administrations from Eisenhower to Johnson repeatedly told Chiang Kai-shek that he could not count on U.S. support for an attack on China. Again, James Lilly.
The people in Taiwan were intent upon engaging the American in a hostile way with China. Ergo, you could not accept their intelligence at face value. You had to cross-check it.
The Black Bats stopped flying missions over China by around 1967. Zhu Zhen is the youngest of the surviving pilots, and he's in his late 70s. He now laughs at the memory of the hardships and danger as if they never happened.
It's all like a dream now. Back then, we were enthusiastic about fighting for our country and our people. At the time, I thought, if I shine for one moment in my life before I leave, then it will have been worth it.
Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Hsinchu, Taiwan.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.
From NPR News, this is a special report from Foreign Dispatch, an in-depth look at China's growing power, filed by NPR correspondents around the world. I'm Ted Clark. Anyone reading the headlines these days can see that China's influence is being felt almost everywhere. Some media refer to this as China's rise. Chinese people see it as their country's rightful return to the commanding position it held for much of the last 2,000 years. In a series of reports now, we take a look at China's growing presence in Southeast Asia, the Middle East, South America, and beyond. China's newfound power takes many forms: economic, cultural, military, and diplomatic. We begin our series with this report on diplomacy from NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Beijing.
In this promotional video, an African employee sings the praises of his Chinese employers. The employer is Jacob Wood, who was born Hu Jieguo in Shanghai and has spent the last 30 years building an African business empire called the Golden Gate Group. It includes hotels, restaurants, construction, and real estate firms, and has 20,000 employees, most of them Nigerians. Wood enjoys the status of an honorary Nigerian chieftain. That came in handy last year when kidnappers seized several groups of Chinese oil workers in Nigeria. Wood used his honorary position to help negotiate for their release. He suggested that oil companies try adopting corporate responsibility.
We tried to help them, but also we tell them, you know, for next time, what they should do, right? We should do more the community jobs, right? Build schools, build hospitals for them. Like, everybody love you. Not let people feel you come here just to take oil.
After years of attracting foreign investment, China is now investing overseas itself, prospecting for new markets and raw materials for its intensive economic growth. In the process, it has taken on new risks, responsibilities, and a national interest beyond its own borders. This is changing China's long-stated policy of non-interference in other countries' affairs. Wu Jianmin remembers serving as a junior diplomat at the United Nations in 1971, when China had just retaken its seat from Taiwan.
Whenever the issue of peacekeeping came up, China would either not participate or abstain. We felt that peacekeeping did not fit our idea of nations minding their own business.
Now, Wu notes, China has 8,000 peacekeeping troops overseas, including this detachment, preparing last year to deploy to Sudan. The message seems to be that it's now okay to interfere in other countries' affairs if you have a United Nations mandate.
We are a part of the existing international system. We are its beneficiaries. The international system is evolving, and we are participating in it and constructing it.
Analysts say China is gradually becoming more responsive to international demands to put diplomatic pressure on authoritarian regimes such as Sudan, North Korea, and Myanmar. China's special envoy on the Darfur issue, Liu Guijin, recently responded to foreign criticism that Beijing is shielding Khartoum from censure.
China's basic policies on the Darfur question are not substantially different from those of Western nations. We agree that the international community should speak with one voice and exert equal influence on the Sudanese government and rebel forces, or as Western nations prefer to say it, exert pressure.
Western governments are far from satisfied with China's contributions on the Darfur issue. Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi recently said that China would shoulder more responsibility for world affairs, but he cautioned that this wasn't just to please any specific countries.
As a developing country, 坦率地讲,
Frankly speaking, China, as a developing country, cannot undertake a level of obligation that goes beyond its capacity. I would like to emphasize that we are not taking international responsibilities to serve the interests of certain countries or a group of countries.
Even the downplaying of its capabilities has become a part of China's foreign policy. Jin Canrong is an international relations expert at People's University in Beijing. He says that China portrays its relations with other countries as a win-win game and aspires to wield power humbly. But Jin adds that as China becomes more powerful and confident, these pledges are coming under increasing criticism.
One direct cause for this is Taiwan's pro-independence provocations. People on the mainland think, we've been putting up with these troublemakers for too long. We ought to just whack them. There are others who say there's no point in downplaying China's capabilities when everyone knows what they are.
China's government has quietly ditched the official term peaceful rise to describe its reemergence as a major power. Critics say that sticking to this description would limit China's options. Other skeptics point out that such a peaceful rise has no precedent in human history. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
The rise of China as a worldwide force stems from its economic power. China needs commodities such as copper and soybeans, and it's found an abundant source in South America. As NPR's Julie McCarthy reports, the relationship between China and South America is helping to transform the global economic order.
In the steamy state of Mato Grosso, straddling Brazil's midsection, 13 million acres of red earth wear a quilt of green that turns golden as soybeans mature for harvest. If soy is king here, farmer Irai Maji is the king maker. The combined farms owned by this 48-year-old soy tycoon, who started out with one tractor, total some 500,000 acres. A battalion of harvesters rumbles across this 100,000-acre farm of his, gargantuan metal creatures that evoke scenes from Star Wars with their relentless advance. Above the din of harvest, a ranch hand gives Irai some good news.
Wow.
The yield is up, he says. It's 1.4 tons per acre. The state average is 1.1 tons, says a nephew. Relatives in this lucrative family business surround Irai, offering facts he says he can't be bothered with, like how much he's worth, or whether he produces more than the governor of Mato Grosso, who happens to be his cousin. Irai Maji credits China for his expanding empire. Touring his farm, he tells me sales to China revived the fortunes of his company, spurring 20% growth.
2 years, and China entrou forte nesses últimos 2-3 anos aí.
2 years ago, we thought of scaling back our planting, but then China started buying our soy. It was our salvation, otherwise we'd be in a mess. So we have to thank China. They can buy as much as they want and we'll deliver a cheap, healthy source of protein.
Because of the growing demand for soy, which is a key nutrient for poultry, swine, and cattle, the price has risen from $150 a ton to $300 a ton. But China keeps buying because it has to provide nourishment for its increasingly prosperous middle class. Raw materials like soy and iron ore form the basis of Brazil's skyrocketing exports to China, which doubled in just 3 years.
So China became a very important partner to Brazil. In fact, China became the second partner to Brazil after the United States.
Brazil's Secretary of International Trade, Velber Bahal. He notes that the trade goes both ways, for a total of $30 billion last year. In fact, as commercial ties intensify, 6% of Brazilian exports went to China, while 10% of all imports came from China. Secretary Bahal says Brazil's new trade deficit is not all bad.
No, not at all, not at all. First of all, because we have this sense that it reduces inflation and it gives more opportunity for the poor population in Brazil that has cheaper goods. On the other hand, as a principle, we don't have to reduce the 10% import from China. We have to increase our exports to 12%.
Actually, Chinese economy and the Brazilian economy are complementary mutually.
This is very good for Brazil.
That's China's ambassador to Brazil, Chengdu Cheng. He says with China, Brazil can reduce its dependence on the U.S. market. He's also optimistic about prospects for Chinese trade throughout Latin America.
The potentiality is very big because the population may be more than 500 million. Their purchasing power is quite considerable, much bigger than Africa, maybe.
Ambassador Du Qing has also had to address apprehensions among some business circles here that a lopsided commercial relationship may be developing.
They are claiming before my arriving here, China is invading, invading with products. But I told them, you know, we understand globalization. Commercial exchange is inevitable. You must buy, we must sell.
The Chinese have been outselling Brazilians in sectors such as shoes. Small factories like this one in Sao Paulo producing high-end shoes survive. Many more factories manufacturing inexpensive models have failed. By one estimate, Chinese competition is responsible for Brazil losing more than 90% of its shoe sector in the U.S. market.
China is an important partner. It's also a big threat.
Former Brazilian ambassador to France, Sergio Amaral, says China's competitive drive makes it a threat, especially, he says, when it engages in dumping or other unfair competition. He cites textiles as an example.
You have suits coming to Brazil for $1.
$1?
$1.
Well, who can compete with that?
Nobody can.
China is importing far more raw materials from Brazil than manufactured products. In addition, China has not kept President Hu Jintao's promise to make sizable investments in South America. For both these reasons, attitudes towards China are beginning to harden here. Soy farmer Irai Maji says he'd love China to invest in the country's long-neglected roads and railways that make transport costs five times what they are in the U.S. But he says,
China investing in infrastructure here? I haven't seen a cent of that. Who from China is going to invest? All I hear is talk, just like a parakeet.
The China-driven soy boom has also alarmed environmentalists, who say it has pushed farming northward into the Amazon rainforest and spoiled rivers with runoff. Conservationist Adalberto Eberhardt says, worse yet, it's all for foreign markets.
We are basically changing nature for money in Brazil. That is the point.
But China's Ambassador Du Qing says developing economies that try to industrialize pollute. Every country must find its own way, he says.
China cannot adopt the same policy as Canadians. It's impossible. I think every country must define its policy according to its reality.
In the broader frame, the U.S. market share in Brazil has declined the past 5 years when China's has surged. Former Brazilian ambassador to Washington, Rubens Barbosa, says the U.S. near-exclusive focus on the war in Iraq made it possible for newcomer China to begin to eclipse the United States in its traditional sphere of influence.
Other countries are benefiting from this growing lack of presence, not to say interest. And other countries, Brazil and China, are taking over in Latin America.
For all the trepidation about closer trade links to China, there is also an air of expectation here. Many Brazilians feel their rising economic prowess is putting them on the path to the developed world. Meanwhile, Ambassador Sergio Amaral says a partnership between such developing powerhouses as Brazil and China will change the world in unprecedented ways.
This superpower, the United States, is facing some checks and balance, if I could say so, and that's positive. A different world is in the offing.
A world that Amaral says is less unipolar and more democratic in its decision-making. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
China's expanding its influence around the world, not just by using its economic and diplomatic clout. China also wields soft power. In this report, NPR's Anthony Kuhn describes China's efforts to spread its culture around the world.
Every year, officials and family members gather in front of the grand halls and ancient cypress trees of Confucius's home to celebrate the philosopher's birth 2,558 years ago. Attendants in embroidered robes do ritual prostrations, and students recite Confucian texts. During the Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976, Confucian statues and books were smashed and burned. But today, Confucius is again a source of pride, and his 77th generation descendant, Kong Deyong, is a busy man. He spoke in his car on the way to the ceremony.
Even if Chinese people haven't entirely understood Confucianism, it has been a part of their entire system of thought for thousands of years. That's why we say it's the essence of our national culture.
Confucianism was at the heart of what made China the soft power powerhouse of Asia for centuries. Most of the time, China was unable to physically conquer its neighbors, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. But these nations willingly adopted Confucian culture and Chinese forms of government, art, and literature. Now Confucius has become a sort of Chinese brand. Since 2002, China has opened more than 200 Confucius Institutes in about 60 countries to teach Chinese language and culture. In 2006, President Hu Jintao visited this Confucius Institute in Nairobi, Kenya, and sang along with its first graduating class. President Hu, can I ask you a question? Says one of the Kenyan students after the singing. Sure, Hu says. Did we sing well? She asks. Yes, you did, Hu replies. That folk song is from my hometown. You sang it well and with Chinese flavor. The girl says that she wants to come to China to study and work, and President Hu welcomes her. Chinese state television broadcast this episode. The message was clear. Foreigners are respectful of China and its culture. But China is careful to point out that the Confucius Institutes aren't pushing any ideological agenda. Zhao Guocheng is an education ministry official in charge of the Confucius Institutes.
Confucius Institutes don't teach Confucianism. They don't promote any particular values. They're just an introduction to Chinese culture, and they're established at the invitation of foreign people who want to understand China.
But in a major speech last year, President Hu, for the first time, specifically pointed to soft power as a national goal. We must enhance culture as part of the soft power of our country, he said, to better guarantee the people's basic cultural rights and interests. Sports are the ultimate soft power competition, and China is betting that hosting the Beijing Olympics this summer will be an unprecedented opportunity to wow the world. Of course, China has been successful in exporting some parts of its culture without any effort on Beijing's part. Like kung fu flicks, basketball star Yao Ming, or Mushu Pork. Ge Jianxiong is a historian at Shanghai's Fudan University. He says that exporting values is much harder than exporting, say, Mushu Pork, because there isn't really that much difference among nations' values.
Some here say, since ancient times, the Chinese people have been industrious, brave, and caring towards the old and the young. I ask them, what nation on earth is not brave, industrious, and caring towards the old and young?
In its official propaganda, China's leaders espouse a harmonious society at home and abroad. Critics scoff at this as an awkward and unconvincing shibboleth. China's leadership developed the harmonious society idea, they say, to paper over the simmering unrest in Chinese society caused by autocratic government, corruption, and a yawning gap between rich and poor. Ding Xueliang is a researcher with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
What kind of ideas and values will China promote to get the world's support? China is poor in this respect. It's not that the Chinese are stupid or lack potential. It's that its government propaganda system is incapable of producing concepts that are attractive to societies with freedom of expression.
Opinion polls suggest that China's public image has recently taken a bruising, particularly in the West. A February poll by Gallup showed that 42% of Americans have a favorable opinion of China, compared to 55% who have an unfavorable one. Last year, the two groups were roughly even. But the situation is different in Asia, where Gallup found a median of 46% of respondents approved of China's leadership, compared to 34% approval of U.S. leadership. Some people argue that China's rapid economic growth is a model worth emulating. Ding Xueliang disagrees.
All you have to do is look at the cost. It's extremely high. The reason there are all these social protests, all this pollution, is because economic growth is the sole objective, while costs have been ignored.
Some pundits talk of a Beijing consensus to be emulated by other countries. It's a combination of economic reform, pragmatic diplomacy, and undemocratic government. But Beijing itself hasn't backed this idea. Wu Jianmin, president of China's Foreign Affairs University, says the formula makes him uncomfortable.
We're still trying to find our own way. To speak of a Beijing consensus or a Washington consensus is too simplistic. There may be some good aspects to Beijing's way, but they may only be suited to China's situation.
Chinese students recite a Confucian rule: don't do unto others what you wouldn't wish upon yourself. Confucius's message on soft power was clear: lead by moral authority, not by force. Keep your own house in order, and others will follow your example. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
To see how Chinese soft power plays out in other countries, we go now to China's own backyard, Southeast Asia. The U.S. once exerted considerably more influence in that region. Now China's influence is on the rise, even in countries that used to be firmly anti-communist. Here's NPR's Southeast Asia correspondent Michael Sullivan.
It wasn't that long ago that Indonesia and China were mortal enemies.
The military still believed until yesterday, actually, that the yellow fever is coming down, you see, this threat of the north, you know.
Harijan Silalahi of Jakarta's Center for Strategic and International Studies says a 1965 coup attempt by Indonesia's Communist Party helped convince the Indonesian military of China's expansionist impulses. The coup was brutally suppressed by Indonesia's U.S.-backed military. More than 500,000 people, many of them communists, were killed in the purge that followed.
At that time, too, Vietnam was in the peak of confrontations, you saw. And then, of course, in China, that is also very aggressive. And every day, nearly six times, radio picking attack the military who are in power here that eliminate the communists, you see. So the confrontation is there.
Indonesia's military leader Suharto saw the country's ethnic Chinese minority as a potential fifth column. As a result, public displays of Chinese culture and heritage were banned. Suhirman is a caretaker at Jakarta's Vihara Dharma Bhakti Temple.
There were no dragon dances or public celebrations. If we wanted to observe the Chinese New Year, we had to do it quietly at home. Even the Chinese characters you see on the walls here were banned during that time because Suharto believed they might contain a hidden political message.
10 years after the fall of Suharto, dragon dances are no longer forbidden, the Chinese New Year an official holiday. Indonesia's ethnic Chinese have their own newspaper, and Chinese firms compete with U.S. and European companies for Indonesia's vast reserves of oil, minerals, and gas. Hari Silalahi.
China is also less aggressive, more active in doing some cultural and business in this area. The present is more non-colonialistic, put it that way. They come here as scholars, as artists and diplomats.
As friends.
And friends to a certain degree.
China is using soft power to make friends all over the region. This is one example. A Chinese language and culture center at Mei Fa Long University in northern Thailand. Several graceful pagoda-like buildings set around a pond, a center built and paid for by the Chinese government.
Oh, very clever.
They are very clever.
Vanchai Sirichanap is the university president.
They understand the way of life here. And they understand the people, so the way they do is solve them than what American did. So using friendship as a spearhead to deal the business.
And it's working.
And it's worked. In terms of Thai students, you know that 5 to 10 years ago, most of them want to go to study in the state. And now the idea changed, you know, a bit to China.
Cheap goods are another example of China's soft power, and they are making life better for some of the region's rural poor. Long Lao Mai, a small village in neighboring Laos, is literally at the end of the road from the ancient Lao capital, Luang Prabang, about an hour and a half drive down a pitted dirt road. Villagers here eke out a living farming, and the arrival of Chinese goods in the markets here a few years back, Headman Saidu Wu says, was a good thing. Before, he says, the markets only had goods from Thailand, and they were too expensive. Now we can buy secondhand clothes, blankets, and things for the kitchen from China, he says, which are far cheaper and almost as good. The biggest change, Chinese motorcycles like this one, that can be had for $500, less than half the price of one from Thailand.
Before, he says, when people were sick, we had to carry them out or wait for the bus, which comes just once a day. Now, he says, if someone is hurt or sick, we can take them straight to the hospital in Luang Prabang.
Soft power of a different sort can be seen here in the Philippines. This new rail line will link Metro Manila to Central Luzon, a $500 million project funded by a low-interest loan from the PRC, one of the newest and biggest donors in the region.
They obviously have been one of the fastest-growing economies in the world. They have had a very successful development experience. And so they have a lot to offer in terms of both knowledge as well as financing.
Larry Greenwood is vice president of the Asian Development Bank in Manila.
Certainly, our experience with China has been very positive in the sense that they are very good at helping design and execute projects, which have had very good impacts and outcomes in terms of development effectiveness.
And many of the projects funded by China come with few strings attached for the governments involved.
China brings to the table a different kind of package.
Titinampong Sudarak, director of the Institute for Security and International Studies at Bangkok's Chulalongkorn University.
They don't have conditions attached to foreign aid. The U.S., the Europeans, they're bent on the promotion of liberal democracies. They have principles about human rights and democratic rule and so on. China does not have the same benchmarks. China understands very well that it wants to build relationships with these countries in Southeast Asia.
China is going to stay. No? I mean, the U.S. can be distracted elsewhere. It can be a distant ally, no? With other priorities. No? China is right next door.
And, says Eileen Baviera, dean of the Asian Center at the University of the Philippines,
they've learned how to speak the language of the region of Southeast Asian diplomacy, multilateralism, you know, confidence building, much more than the United States has.
But not everyone is as sanguine about China's influence or its intentions. Demonstrators in Vietnam's capital, Hanoi, protesting what they see as Chinese aggression in the Spratly Islands, an oil-rich area in the South China Sea claimed by both countries. Such displays are rare in communist Vietnam, but were tolerated by the government in part because they tap into a deep well of nationalism with roots in Vietnam's long and often bitter experience with its neighbor to the north. More than 1,000 years of occupation and conflict that have left many Vietnamese deeply suspicious of China, now Vietnam's second largest trading partner. 23-year-old Vu Thi Tu Chang worries China is using its economic power to nibble away at Vietnam's territorial and cultural integrity.
I don't trust them at all. China is already the new colonial power in the region. If our government doesn't do something soon, we'll lose our sovereignty and our independence. If things continue like this, Vietnam culture won't be gone. It won't simply disappear.
Vietnam's government has a more pragmatic view of its powerful neighbor, whose appetite for raw materials has helped fuel Vietnam's booming economy. Economic integration and interdependence, another example of how China's soft power is transforming the region. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Hanoi.
Coming up, China's growing presence in the Middle East, the Russian Far East, and China's growing military power.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
With its booming economy fueling a voracious demand for energy, China is soon expected to become the world's leading oil importer, much of it coming from the Persian Gulf region. China's rise there coincides with a potential recession in the United States and a badly tarnished U.S. image in the Middle East. That has some Western analysts talking about a historic shift to the East. But the view from the region is not just yet. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from the United Arab Emirates.
In 2005, Saudi Arabia's newly crowned King Abdullah set off on his first foreign visit as leader of the largest oil producer on the planet. His destination was not the world's largest oil importer and only superpower, the United States. Instead, in what some saw as a harbinger of a new era, he visited China. And while the king has his own plane, he took a popular route. There are now at least twice as many flights between the Gulf and China as there are between the Gulf and the U.S. Saudi Arabia, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates are all shipping huge amounts of oil to China. Across this serene stretch of turquoise water in Abu Dhabi, an oil tanker rides high at a loading dock waiting for cargo. When you get a little closer, however, you're quickly enveloped by the industrial sound of a Middle East oil producer pumping and shipping crude at or near capacity. As China's energy appetite has grown, Beijing increasingly values its ties with the oil-rich and relatively stable countries in the Gulf.
From ports like this one, crude oil sets sail for all corners of the globe. And in recent years, more and more of it is bound for China. Hunger for oil has pushed China to seek out ties in a number of the world's trouble spots. Angola, Nigeria, Sudan, and Iran. China's economic interests in Sudan and Iran in particular sometimes put it at odds with the West. And China's been forced to modify, at least somewhat, its desire to keep its focus on trade and not politics.
After long ignoring the atrocities of government-backed militias in Western Sudan, China has recently begun prodding the government in Khartoum and rebel groups to negotiate. China has also endorsed three UN Security Council resolutions sanctioning Iran over its nuclear program. But those shifts have not been reflected in Beijing's trade and economic policies on the ground. Its new rhetoric notwithstanding, China remains Sudan's biggest weapons supplier. And in Tehran, Foreign Ministry official Ali Rezai told NPR that despite the UN resolutions, Chinese investment in Iran is booming.
You know, it's interesting to see all those investments and issues are intact. They have their own business with us. At the same time, they are under too much pressure from the U.S. side.
But it's not just Washington that's unhappy with China's strengthening economic ties to Iran. Analyst Mustafa Al-Ani at the Gulf Research Center in Dubai says China may soon be forced to sacrifice some of its interests in Iran if it wants to maintain good ties with the Arab world and access to its oil.
This is not a marginal issue. This is a major issue here in the region. If China wants to emerge as a major power in the region, supplying 60% of Chinese energy, they must understand the relation buyer and seller will not last for long.
Al-Ani says the atmosphere in the region is one of extreme uncertainty, with the U.S. image badly tarnished by the invasion of Iraq and the ensuing rise of Iran. Some are looking to China to step in, but for now, Al-Ani remains skeptical.
Certainly in the region we feel the United States losing credibility. And we feel that in the near future, we're going to see a vacuum in the region. But we still believe the Chinese is not a mature power. Politically, it's still really very weak. Strategically, it still is not trusted. We don't feel China is a replacement to the United States in any sense.
But economically, the shift is well underway. For centuries, Imperial China and the Mideast had thriving economic ties as goods traveled back and forth along the Silk Road. Then, in the mid-20th century, communist China served as an ideological model, and sometimes arms supplier, to Arab nationalists and socialists in the region. But analyst Abdelmonem Saeed Ali at the Al Aram Center for Strategic and Political Studies says today the message from China is not one of egalitarian redistribution of power and wealth, quite the opposite.
Actually, China is giving two bad lessons to the Middle East. Number one, violating human rights has nothing to do with development. You can have both. The second is that highly centralized political power does not mean necessarily an impediment for progress. It is usually China is used as an example against local reformers.
It's a model that democracy advocates loathe, but the economic allure of the new China is impossible to ignore. It is perhaps nowhere more obvious than here at Dragon Mart. This 1.6 million square foot shopping complex, nearly three quarters of a mile long, sprawls more or less in the shape of a dragon along the Dubai-Oman Highway. Here, some 4,000 Chinese firms offer everything from children's toys and double happiness cigarettes to forklifts and heavy machinery. Officials say it may be the largest Chinese trading hub outside mainland China. At the same time, with Mideast investors finding it harder to conduct business in the U.S., their money is increasingly flowing east. Dubai-based DP World, burned by a political backlash in the U.S. after it acquired American port holdings, is now funding a $500 million port project in China. Tens of billions of dollars worth of oil projects are underway. Inexpensive Chinese cars are selling as fast as they arrive in Egypt. And to the dismay of Egyptian craftspeople, most pharaonic souvenirs now come with a Made in China sticker. One Gulf economist predicts that regional investment in Asia, including China, could reach $250 billion within 5 years. But many of these oil-rich states will be watching China's evolving Mideast policy carefully, hoping Beijing recognizes that it will have problems becoming and remaining an economic superpower if it doesn't pay more attention to political relations in this sensitive and complicated corner of the world. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Dubai.
As China's booming economy expands, few places in the world have been more directly affected than China's once mighty neighbor to the north, Russia. Russia's sprawling Far East is emptying as Russians abandon their depressed region. But Chinese people and capital are moving in. NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer traveled to the city of Blagoveshchensk on the Amur River that divides Russia and China and filed this report.
Russia's relationship with China couldn't be any more starkly clear than in this isolated border town. In the 1960s, the former communist allies fought bloody skirmishes along the river. When relations began to thaw in the 1980s, Chinese flocked across the border to buy Soviet cars, farm machinery, kitchen utensils, anything they could get their hands on. Now the trade moves in the opposite direction. Here on Blagoveshchensk's litter-strewn bank of the narrow Amur River, I can see the Chinese city of Haihe on the other side. Blagoveshchensk is a depressed city, but in Haihe on the other side, you can see a lot of construction. The city is growing quickly along the riverbank, and it's the Chinese who are helping sustain life here in Russia. In winter, trucks and buses cross the ice in both directions. When the ice begins melting in spring, passengers board small hovercrafts that skim over the river and up the sandy banks, kicking up large clouds of dust. On the Chinese side of the river, people overloaded with large plastic bags packed with clothes and other Chinese goods cram onto ferries that leave every few minutes. The passengers are mostly Russians, paid by Chinese to carry goods to the other side. Back in Blagoveshchensk, Chinese vendors hawk some of the goods at a bustling outdoor market, just as in other cities across Russia's Far East. But the Chinese do more than sell merchandise here. They're also finding other lines of work. Next to one stall, cobbler Yo Chao Ching hammers new soles onto a pair of shoes. He says it's far easier to find work here than in China. The math says it all. Russia's vast, empty Amur region has fewer than a million residents. The Chinese region of Heilongjiang across the river is bursting at the seams with almost 40 million people. There's no work on the Chinese side at all, Yo says in Russian. New strict Russian immigration laws have limited the number of Chinese working in Blagoveshchensk, but Yo says finding employment is still easier on this side of the river. In addition to clothes and electronics, most food for sale here comes from China. Blagoveshchensk also has many Chinese restaurants and cafes, but in a city dominated by old, decaying log houses and squat Soviet concrete hulks, the biggest sign of the Chinese presence is construction. A bulldozer digging next to the towering glass facade of the Asia Hotel. Set to open in May, it's the tallest building by far in Blagoveshchensk. It'll have the city's only world-class accommodation, and it's being built by a Chinese company. When its CEO drives up, he's in his Bentley Coupe, the only such car in the Amur region. Speaking in the massive revolving restaurant, He Wenyan says Blagoveshchensk would be far worse off without the Chinese. We're good for the Russians, He says. We're helping sustain their market economy. But most Chinese in Blagoveshchensk maintain a low profile and keep to themselves. Racist hate crimes are on the rise in Russia, and nationalists speak of a Chinese menace growing on Russia's border. But Blagoveshchensk residents tend to be less suspicious of the Chinese than even a few years ago. On the city's main street, clothes designer Tatiana Sarokina says she feels closer to China than Moscow, in the European part of Russia, thousands of miles away.
That's just a fact of life. After all, China's just across the river. We depend on the Chinese for so many things. Any development here is good for us.
Dependence on China is hardly new here. Residents say they wouldn't have weathered Russia's steep economic decline in the 1990s without affordable Chinese products. An 80-year-old Nikolai Alexandrovich says he remembers surviving mainly on potatoes from China during the worst years of Stalinism in the 1930s.
Today we'd be walking around naked and hungry if it weren't for the Chinese, because our own authorities are just concerned with battling each other for control and lining their own pockets. They've only helped Russia's Far East decline.
But while locals feel they have much to gain from the Chinese, analysts warn that the Kremlin is in denial about the long-term threat to Russia's Far East. China is buying Russian arms for its major military buildup and pressuring Moscow to speed the building of oil and gas pipelines to feed China's insatiable and growing need for energy, even as Russia faces problems meeting its own energy demands. Sociologist German Zhelibyovsky says Moscow doesn't realize sooner or later Russia will have to share land with China. Our military alone won't be able to hold the Far East, Zhelibyovsky says. There have to be Russian people living here. Zhelibyovsky points out that Russia took Blagoveshchensk from the Chinese only in 1856 and that China may soon control the city once again. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Blagoveshchensk.
We conclude our series on China and the world with a look at the Chinese military. In nearly every aspect of military capability, from cruise missiles to submarines, satellites to cluster bombs, China has been working hard to modernize its armed forces. This has been cause for some concern in Asia and in the United States. Some see this as a natural result of China's emergence as a rising power. Others see danger to the United States and its interests in Asia. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The evidence of China's military modernization is ample. Double-digit increases for military spending since 1989, the rapid expansion of China's cruise and ballistic missile force, and the deployment of hundreds of missiles along China's coast across from Taiwan. The rapid expansion of China's submarine force and the modernization of the missiles those submarines carry. And last year, China's destruction of one of its own satellites by a land-based missile, announcing China's unexpected capability in anti-satellite warfare. There is no doubt that China is a rising military power, says former Defense Department official Kurt Campbell, who now heads the Center for a New American Security.
No country has risen
to a status of great power as rapidly as China has, I would argue, over the last 20 years.
With its rapidly expanding economy, its growing thirst for energy, and its own perception of itself as an emerging power, it makes perfect sense that China should modernize its military capabilities, says Ralph Kossa, director of the Pacific Forum, a think tank in Honolulu.
They want to have a force commensurate with their political and economic standing in the world, and we shouldn't be surprised by that, and we shouldn't necessarily be frightened by that.
Still, some are frightened by that. They see China's expansion of its military as a direct challenge to the U.S. Just peruse the titles of several new books, The Coming War with China, or Showdown, Why China Wants War with the United States, and China Shakes the World, A Titan's Rise and Troubled Future. Susan Shirk is not among the alarmists. Still, in her recently published China, Fragile Superpower, Shirk writes, history teaches us that rising powers are likely to provoke wars.
Let's remember why they provoke war. They provoke war because of the reactions of the present-day powers and not only because of their own behavior. And I have to say that there are reasons to be worried on both scores.
Perhaps no one knows more right now about China's military and especially its naval capabilities than Admiral Timothy Keating. Keating is head of Pacific Command, based in Honolulu. It's his job to watch China's military and watch it closely. He's been to China several times, seen its weapon systems up close, held talks with China's military leaders. He admits China is developing impressive military capabilities, but he says,
the Chinese are behind us. Unmistakably, they know it. In their words, I'm quoting some of them, they're 25 years behind us.
One of the reasons that some analysts in the U.S. are so concerned about China's military development is that it is in part hidden. Chinese leaders have not explained why they shot down their own satellite last year, why a Chinese submarine last year shadowed the U.S. aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk, or why they talk about acquiring aircraft carriers of their own. China needs to be more transparent about its military, and Keating says little by little they are.
Increased transparency can yield to greater trust. That reduces the potential for misunderstanding. Misunderstanding can lead to conflict or crisis.
No area is more fraught with potential conflict for China and the U.S. than Taiwan, which China regards as part of its territory. The recent presidential election in Taiwan, won by a candidate who wants to improve relations with the mainland, may go a long way to cooling potential conflict there. But, says Susan Shirk, China's military modernization has been all about Taiwan, and denying the U.S. military access to Taiwan and the area around it in case conflict breaks out.
They want us to really think twice about confronting China's military power in such a contingency.
China does have the capacity to threaten the actual homeland of the United States. It possesses 20 intercontinental ballistic missiles that carry nuclear warheads and could reach the U.S. But these missiles are not on high alert, and the warheads are stored separately from the missiles. Although China is modernizing these missiles, it believes its nuclear arsenal is a minimum deterrent, and in recent years it has not modified that doctrine. Kurt Campbell believes that, with the attention of the U.S. focused primarily on the Middle East, recent administrations have not paid enough attention to what is going on with China's military.
So it's not, I think, any outward and, you know, specific steps that China has taken that are cause for immediate American concern. But it is a pattern of very substantial steps that have led to a rather sharp increase in Chinese power.
China's recent unrestrained crackdown in Tibet adds another element to an understanding of China's military. The People's Liberation Army is used not only against foreign threats, but also against internal challenges, as China's civilian communist leadership sees them. In order to maintain the PLA's loyalty to the civilian leadership, Susan Shirk believes, the military demands and gets its way on military spending. That is not a strength of the Chinese system, in Shirk's view.
I see it more as a reflection of China's internal weakness and that they need to satisfy the military in order to keep the Communist Party in power.
That's why Shirk calls China a fragile superpower. The current events in Tibet are the most recent evidence of just that. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
For more international coverage, listen to your local NPR station, which you can find on npr.org. Or, while you're there, click on News and World. This is Ted Clark, NPR News.